Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And remember these words. Take it back now. Each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network. Michael Hohmeyer with us. Michael, hi, how are you?
I'm terrific, Michael Ray. Glad to be with you.
Oh, and I'm so glad you're back. There's so many things going on. Now, as an attorney, and if someone was entering a contract with you and they told you that certain things would be a certain way and this is how they felt about things, and then you signed the contract and you got into it, and now all of a sudden everything they said wasn't and they changed it all around, would you sue them?
Absolutely right, of course. And the law exists to uphold contracts as written.
Or implied.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we have two kinds of a contract, one that you write, then the one that you that you're saying, and it's implied you're going to do these certain things. Now, let's take it to the administration. Why isn't there, why don't you think there's consequence for someone, whether it be Obama, anybody, who says they're going to do a certain thing, and then midstream they change? Is that not breaking the contract?
Well, absolutely it is, and that's why so many of the population feel that they were sold a bill of goods when they voted in 2008, thinking they were going to get what was promised to them. And, of course, we know over the last 2 years, the contract that was promised for hope and change was not adhered to at all.
Okay, so effectively, when we hear something like hope and change doesn't happen, it's not adhered to. But the problem I think we're having is, and again, it could be anybody in office. Now we have another 2 years before anything can get done. I thought, and I didn't realize it until the Bill Clinton debacle, that impeachment meant you're out of office. But impeachment doesn't mean that. The only thing impeachment is a slap on the hands for doing something bad, quote unquote. And I don't necessarily know if there's anything to make somebody do what they're supposed to do when you have voted for them.
Well, there are consequences to that, and you're absolutely right. There may be no way of exercising leverage other than voting the next time one gets a chance. But I do believe that there will be that day of reckoning. It will be here in 2 years, just like in November, people finally got a chance to vote on the first 2 years. They'll vote on the next 2 years and the full 4 years of this presidency. In 2012, less than a year and a half away now.
Now, by the way, I think that one of the biggest problems that we see in this stage of the game is that obviously the president is moving center. Every time he hears a problem, he goes left and he moves back to center. Now, the left is starting to get upset with this man. So he's losing popularity left and right. But herein lies the problem with that. He's losing popularity, but he's still got a good chance of being reelected because of one thing. There's no hero coming out of the right. There isn't anybody strong enough at this stage of the game to take the reins and lead the charge.
Well, that's correct. But again, it is a year and a half away. The debates in the Republican Party are not going to start in earnest until this fall. So we have a number of months before we would expect somebody to emerge. And in fact, if we can remember, I believe it was true that in 1980, although Ronald Reagan was viewed in many quarters as being the candidate presumptive, there were an awful lot of others who said, oh no, anybody but Reagan. He had his shot in 76. He blew it. He's too old. He's too crazy. He's too much of a warmonger. He's too much of an actor, etc. And it wasn't a slam dunk in 1980, if I can remember way back into the mists of time, that Reagan was assured of getting the nomination. So There are front runners today as there were back then. Maybe not as clear among many, but there will emerge a candidate, hopefully a one that's truly acceptable for a majority of the party, including conservatives, unlike, I think, what happened in 2008. So I think it's too early to write off the party as not having a standard bearer that most of the party can rally behind starting in the early part of 2012.
There's two people that I like, and the problem with the two people that I like is there's an element that they seem to be missing. The first one I like is I like Trump, and the reason I like Trump is because he has that ability to see what business is about. Now, obviously, you know, they're going to rip him apart, and who knows if he'll make it or not, but I would like to see somebody with a good, strong grasp on business to handle it. And I think what he said, a few of the things he said, I would stand right behind. You know, we're doing how many trillions of dollars we've spent in Afghanistan while we're taking away from Medicare here. Poverty is going on. We can't control, you know, the population, quote unquote. When I say control, crime, unbelievable crime all over the country.
Yes.
That said, okay. So we need somebody to look at where the money should really go at this stage of the game, not somebody to stand up there and every other word out of his mouth is the children. You know, the children at this stage of the game have been used, abused, and reused. It's getting to a point where it doesn't work anymore. The other one that
that's a very powerful statement that you just made. It's getting to the point where it doesn't work anymore. That's your fault. That's the fault of others in talk radio, on the Internet, on the World Wide Web, and those voices outside the mainstream media, because you exist, Michael Ray, and your fellows, that's a huge part of why it doesn't work anymore, it being the mainstream media trying to shove the same message down our throats saying, oh, well, anybody who opposes Obama has to be racist by definition. Uh-uh. Most Americans don't buy that anymore, and it's borne up time and again. And the reason they don't buy it is because they know better, and a big reason why they know better is because they have the alternative information sources of you and your fellows. That, I think, is a huge part of what makes it a game changer. People know they were sold a bill of goods, which gets us back to what you opened with. People know that if they oppose the deficit-expanding policies of this administration, that they're not bad, evil human beings. They don't buy that pabulum anymore, and they're going to vote showing that they don't buy this anymore. And in a large part, it's your fault.
No, absolutely. I'll take the blame for that any day of the week.
And
I think a large part of this is when we take a look at it, it's the process that we go through. What I have seen in this administration, and Michael, I hate to admit it, but I've seen a lot of administrations in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But what I've seen in this one, especially a division of the classes, upper class, lower class, middle class is starting to be disintegrating. It seems to be flowing away. And here's some of the problem. They talk about, you know, that there's non-equality and so on and so forth. Yes, in the 50s and the 60s there was, and before that there was horrible segregation. There's no question about that. But it's not that way now. There are some people who don't want to hire somebody black, some people who don't want to hire somebody white. And right now, there are planning to, and they're going through, there's some of the black organizations that are going through city after city, and they're basically saying, don't do business with anybody white, don't do business with anybody that doesn't think the way we think, and on and on and on. The separation between the races, I have never seen as strong as it is right now. I watched and I listened to Louis Farrakhan the other night say in a video film, it's not hearsay, and there was somebody who didn't come to an opening or something to honor somebody who happened to have been African-American. Farrakhan said, the only reason it didn't happen because the guy's a Jew and he's not going to stand up for, and he used the N-word. And he said, I know I said the N-word. So when you've got these kind of things going on, what you have is a complete imbalance of whatever equality is supposed to be. If we're going to get together, it's got to come from both sides. And these people who are leading the charge, the Sharptons, the Farrakhans, the rest of them, they live a life of luxury. They don't live like most of the people who follow them. And I think therein lies the problem. They talk the talk, but they do not walk the walk.
That's correct. I absolutely endorse that view. Sadly, that's the case. However, significantly, that case is not reflective of what is American society and American culture today. You're absolutely right that where we are today is night and day from where we were 25, 30, 50 years ago.
Sure.
And I see it in my own practice. It happens that I'm a regular old white guy. My partner is a Chinese American. We have two attorneys who work with us. One is a black gentleman. The other is a female. That's four attorneys, and not by intent, almost by accident, it just happened that we're rather a rainbow, I guess you'd say, and that, in fact, also is indicative of our client base. We have clients, and as you know, we represent small and medium-sized businesses, no litigation, exclusively businesses starting, growing, and occasionally helping them sell. And our clients include businessmen and women, and includes them from every race, whether they are black, Hispanic, Asian, or Indian. And I mean by that, I mean Indians from Southeast Asia. So we have folks from Africa, Latin America, South America, Australia. It just happens. We're doing international law, so I guess you could say we get a lot of folks internationally, but we also get Americans. And those people are interested in living the American dream regardless of culture, race, ethnicity, and all the rest. So while these guys are going ahead, and the administration also is going ahead and dividing the American people by class and by wealth and by culture and by race, the American people are not dividing themselves that way anymore. This is a huge change in America, and eventually those voices who are seeking to continue to divide us, I predict they're going to run out of steam because they're no longer relevant to the America that exists today.
No, absolutely. No question about it. And I saw something that was an article that got sent to me, had to be within the last week or so. It was about a young man. They titled it The Death of an Entrepreneur. It was a young African-American out of New York who somehow, he I don't know if he was killed, but he died. The key here is that he had six daughters and three sons. He was pulling in $1,360
wow.
a piece for these kids through welfare. You know, you multiply that by nine and you've got, he's making money. So when they talk about inequality and when they talk about the entitlement programs, there's something that has to be looked at. You know, if you want to take away from Medicare, which covers black, white, yellow, orange, green, indifferent, it doesn't really matter, or Social Security. But when you get into something like this, why not have child after child after child if the government's going to pay for it?
Yes, of course. Those incentives, unfortunately, they still exist. And the way to break that cycle is the way that Republicans and Democrats got together to fix the welfare system back when Clinton was president. He had to be dragged kicking and screaming to doing the right thing, but he did it, and he's entitled to credit for it. And the positive impact on not only state budgets and the federal budget even, and also on welfare recipients by the change in the welfare laws that happened, you know, a decade ago has been significant, and everybody involved should rightly take credit for it. That's the kind of proactive, creative fixing that we need to have now. And we need to have it now, not just philosophically, but because there isn't any money anymore to support things going the way that they're going. And so these policies, these programs, they need to be fixed where they can be fixed. They need to be made to work more efficiently at less expense. That can be done. When we talk about cutting spending, it does not necessarily require that every single positive social program is going to be eliminated.
Michael, let me interrupt just for a minute. When we talk about cutting spending, if you go through and you look at all of the committees, those areas of government that are set to challenge certain things, you've got an overrun. You've got maybe 20, 30 committees doing the exact same thing, and they're being paid for it. You've got 22 people that follow around the president's wife, and you know they're the assistants, the whatever, and you've got all of the czars going on. The president himself makes over $400,000 a year, and now what he's gotten from his book, that's a whole other story. That has nothing to do with the taxpayer. but you got $400,000 a year plus another $50,000, I think it is, in expense money. Plus, anytime you want to go someplace, you jump on Air Force One, which costs you know how much a mile, quote unquote.
Oh, yes.
Then you've got Congress people who are making just at $200,000 a year. So the point of contention is if they want to cut, start at home. Don't start that, you know, start with what you have. And if you can't get out by on less than $200,000 a year, then you got nothing to say about what we're giving away. Stop giving them trillion some odd dollars to Afghanistan when we're suffering right here. How much money are we spending in Europe and in Asia, South American countries? We're giving it away. And all we have to do is start drilling for oil right here. Israel can drill for oil. We should back them up. And the problem wouldn't be the same. You're talking about $5 and $6 a gallon in Europe right now. And if you go to Saudi Arabia, I think it's less than a buck a gallon. There's something wrong with the picture. Why are we paying what we pay when we have the ability and the facility and the wherewithal to do it right here?
All of which is absolutely true, and all of those measures you're speaking of need to be adopted as part of the fix, part of the cure. And I believe that those are going to be logical follow-ons to the Republican Ryan budget that has been proposed. I think it's drastically important that in some shape and form something like that gets adopted. But, you know, the problem with the spending is there isn't enough money, even if you took everybody's money away, to cover the deficit that we're running and pay for all the programs and pay for the debt that is going to accelerate, payments on the debt that's going to accelerate over the next 15 to 20 years, we just don't have enough money. If you confiscated every penny from every millionaire and billionaire in the United States, people have estimated it to be $9 trillion, $10 trillion,
sure,
you still couldn't right this ship just by confiscating their money. There's just not enough. The only way to fix things, you got to cut spending in all of the ways that you suggested and more.
No, and obviously, and I'm going to go harp on this oil thing. And the reason I'm harping on that is this. When gas goes up to over $5 a gallon, it doesn't just affect you and I. It's going to cost you, what, $60 to fill your tank up? It's not going to just affect you and I. It's going to affect the people in transportation. It's going to affect the ability for people to go the places that they wanted to go. Look at all the vacation places and everything else that's going to go out of business because people can't afford to drive there, quote unquote. So it has a far-reaching internal effect. And because of this far-reaching internal effect, we are not going to become who we are. As long as we're indebted to someone, as long as we have an administration who puts fear in our hearts, if we don't do this, we are nothing more than automatons. And the more we owe, the more they know that they can control.
And because of those things that you're mentioning right now, again, this takes us full circle back to where you started our discussion today. This is why people say we were sold a bill of goods. We were lied to. We were told these were not going to be the policies that were followed by this administration. But in fact, they've turned out to be. And people don't like what it is they turned out they've really gotten. And they don't like the fact that they didn't get what they thought they were getting. And they don't like that they were lied to about the difference between those two things. So on all of those grounds, I don't see how a president like this president gets back his credibility. I mean, once you lie to me, and I know you're a liar, even if I want desperately to believe you again, I will never be able to 100% trust you the way I did before you had never lied to me the first time. And I don't believe this man has a very good chance of getting reelected because of the number of people who say, I know he can't be trusted, and what he says may or may not, but probably won't, be the way things actually go if he's given four more years. When he runs for re-election next year, he will be in a hugely, radically different place, if I can use that word, than where he was running in 2007, 2008. And this is not going to be a replay of the election in 2008. This is going to be an entirely different election, an entirely different landscape. And I frankly think because of himself, and nothing to do with a single Republican, but because of himself, he's going to have a devil of a time getting reelected.
Now, by the way, we knew what we're starting to run out of time, but we knew what we had going in. He told us what he was going to do. He was going to fundamentally change America. He said that to the unions. He said that to the Acorn groups. He said that to them. Nobody wanted to listen. And you know me well enough. You've known me for years now. I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a pragmatist when it really comes down to it. But if you take a look at the step-by-step destroying this economy, the step-by-step getting us into debt, the step-by-step causing us to be indebted to, quote-unquote, for the most part, our enemies, it's very hard for me to believe that this isn't intentional. This is not a stupid man. That man is brilliant, and he's got a staff that causes him to be so. So there's got to be some intention behind this, and we're gonna leave it at that. But the one thing that I'm going to do is this. The reason that my book hasn't been out, something happened, and we're changing the title of it, all right? The title of it is now, and this is going to be the title and the impetus of the show and everything else. It's called Take It Back Now, and I'm going to be on your doorstep for an endorsement on the back of the book.
You've got it.
I got that. Okay, and since it was just you and I talking, I know you weren't under any pressure.
Absolutely not.
Hey, Michael Hohmeyer, hey, website we can find you at.
We're at www.homeyerlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
And by the way, after what we just went through in the last 20 minutes or so, I'm not telling anybody where I'm at. Let them come after you.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, Michael Hohmeyer, see you next week.
Looking forward to it, Michael Roy. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And think about it and let it brand. Take it back now.
Just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
Todd Rutherford back with us, the founder of AskThePublishingGuru.com, and as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, marketing for more than 2,500 different books and counting. Hey, Todd, welcome back.
Great to be here, Michael.
Oh, how are you?
A little bit of allergies. This season of the year just really messes with my my eyes get itchy, my ears, burn, and I get asthma. So, but doctor puts me on all kinds of medications, and none of it works.
By the way, I was going to say, how are you? The cough happens. I was waiting to hear a thud. feel good. By the way, let me get into this, and I won't keep you too long because I am concerned about your health. The L.A. Times Festival of Books is at the end of the month, and I was there about 4 or 5 years ago, and it is really a good place for authors to be. Now, let me ask you this. Are there other events like that? Should authors go to these places?
Well, not every festival is a good idea. And what you really have to analyze, first of all, let me say that the L.A. Festival Times event is definitely worth being there if you're in the area. I don't know that it's necessarily justifiable for somebody to fly in and be there You know, because they have different size booths for an independent author that you can. There's a couple of different sizes you can get of like a $500 spot. You could go in with another independent author and get a spot. It's probably too late to get any spots this year. They might still have some openings, but I definitely have had many clients that are in the area or, you know, within a short, you know, driving distance, you know, maybe a couple hundred miles at the most. Definitely you can go there, you know, spend a couple of days. You're going to have a lot of people that are going to come back. And now if you just sit there at your, you know, behind your table and have your book propped up and expect people to come up and start a conversation with you, you're wasting your time. But if you are, you know, aggressive and willing to stand up and say, hey, come on over here, let me talk to you, what kind of books do you like, and, you know, build a relationship with people as they come by, you've got a real good chance of selling a lot of books because you have such a huge number of people that come through there. There's most likely going to be a good group of people that have interest in the subject matter or genre that you have available. So, as far as other festivals and ideas like that, definitely you have to really calculate how much is it going to cost me to be there and how many people am I going to be exposed to. And then, you know, even like a home and garden show, if you had a book that was obviously something about how to decorate your home or how to garden more effectively or something like that, you know, you're going to have a tremendous amount of people, but it might. You have to look at, okay, if my book's a $10 book or it's a $20 book and I'm getting it at, you know, half that price or 60 or 70% off or whatever, you got to calculate your, you know, average profit per book and then try to determine, extrapolate, you know, a rough idea if you can usually find out from the festival what their attendance was or the book fair or flea market or whatever the case might be, you can find out what their attendance was the previous year of actual, you know, potential buyers of a book, and then you can use your standard mathematical formulas of 10% or less. I mean, direct mail, 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, so the numbers can be very, very similar. If there's going to be 10,000 people, you know, if you sell 1% of them your book, you know, then will that make you enough profit to be able to actually cover your cost of being there and, you know, make a profit?
Now, let's go to the next level just for a moment. When I say the next level, Todd, there are so many people over the years, and it's inevitable. They get a book out, and it's popular. People like it. The story is great. The next thing that I get asked is, who do I talk to make a movie out of it? Now, the real question here is, how do they choose some of these books to make movies out of?
Well, you know, there's definitely the books that have become – most of the books that have become movies or TV series have been fiction. And, you know, there are certain types of books that work well and other books that don't. I mean, Jennifer Egan's book, Goon Squad, was just optioned by HBO. I understand you know what an option is, but, you know, for your listeners – the option doesn't necessarily mean that they'll end up going through with it. They may just do a pilot, they may just do a test and end up canning the whole thing. But, sure. You know, the Jennifer Egan's novel, which was called A Visit from the Goon Squad, you know, basically HBO is developing it as a series. And part of the book's resonance is the way that it spins out individual stories out of chronological sequence, spanning decades, characters and locations. You know, that'll probably thread well together on screen, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see if the series will work, you know, the way that her book jumps completely from chapter to chapter, you know, in a unique way that you wouldn't expect to happen a lot of times. And so, you know, I tell folks when you're, with the popularity of, you know, you've had a lot of movies come out recently that are centered on movies or are centered around books originally. You know, most noteworthy, obviously, that a lot of people are really familiar with, the vampire novels with Stephanie Meyer. But, you know, also, I Am Number Six. There was a sci-fi movie that came out recently that was based on a book, and it did really well. And of course, you got the Chronicles of Narnia that were based on a book, and, many of your dramas, especially your thrillers and murder mysteries, many of them started out as books. And, you know, what you want to do, if you want to think about this as you're writing your novel as a novelist, I mean, go ahead and take a look at some of the books that became movies. I mean, go back the last 3 to 5 years and take a look at the different books that became movies and kind of look at the way that their plots developed. One of the things that's really important, for instance, is you don't see very many really far-fetched books become movies. The more far-fetched it is, the more complicated it would be. You have to think, how would this translate to film? Because the more complicated it is, let's use the vampire novels, for instance, with a lot of special effects. And whenever you have a lot of special effects, you have a very high budget. And so it's even harder to get the book to ever have a chance of being considered for a script, either for film or television. And so that's one thing to be mindful, you know, if you're writing a novel and hope to one day, you know, have it be considered for screen, you know, you want to be mindful that you're, you know, obviously you want to build really exciting, amazing things into your story, but you also want to be considered to not go too far, because the farther you go, the more expensive it's going to be to produce on screen, and therefore the more the less likely or it's going to be to get considered for investment.
Now, by the way, we've got, you know, a million plus brand new authors out there, and there's a lot of writers, but not everybody makes it, obviously. Not everybody can make it. There's a certain something special within somebody innate that causes them to be looked at, and they learn and they study and they know what to do. But what blocks writers usually from reaching that pro level?
Well, you know, there's several different resources out there that talk about kind of the differences between a pro-level writer and someone who's an amateur. You want to read and study everything you possibly can about how to write effectively. If you haven't gone to college, university level and actually studied specifically, you know, for a Master's of Arts in Literature, perhaps, or something to that effect, you know, you need to do, you know, just throwing together a story that sounds good to your friends and family doesn't really mean it's going to have a chance to do well. Although the marketplace, we don't have the same, it's changing drastically, so we don't have the same level of scrutiny. I mean, pretty much anybody can go out and self-publish their book on the Kindle and get started and possibly do well, but there's still going to be some certain things. And like one of the blogs that I follow is called writerunboxed.com, and they happened to had a post this week that I sent out on my Twitter feed that there was an agent that was talking about concerning submissions that sent to them. They always kind of go through, you know, just the first few pages and make a decision to continue. And the majority of them do not even get past the first few pages. And the main reasons that they mentioned was telling instead of showing. An example of that would be, you know, if you're writing and you just said, Billy Bob walked into the room and he was really worried, that would be telling. But showing would be, say, Billy Bob stumbled and opened his eyes widely and quickly began to chatter his teeth. You know, that's the difference between telling and showing, because the second option shows you through visual, in using your imagination, that he was obviously worried and anxious, but I didn't actually have to tell you. I was able to show you through the words.
You recognize.
That's one of the common mistakes that simple amateurs make versus someone who's an experienced writer.
No, by the way, the image or the story is a way to build connection to whatever you're saying. What it does, it puts facts into context and it delivers it with emotional impact. Everybody sees it, they see it in their own way, and they've connected with the entire audience. It's true. It's the difference between talking to and talking at an audience. There is a way that I've learned over all of these years to really connect, and that way of connection is not when somebody understands you, when somebody recognizes what you're saying. Because that hits the emotional realm of the mind, of the brain, and that's what people connect with. And then the story, as you're saying, or that example, the example in and of itself connects with everybody, and it's in everybody's frame of reference.
There you go.
Yeah, and I think that's where the... I should write a book.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
You should write a book.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much time we have, but I but there's a couple of other points that I could make regarding backstory. How are we doing?
We're doing fine. We've got about 5-6 minutes.
Oh, excellent. Well, okay, so another common mistake that people make, especially in fiction, is including unnecessary backstory. The backstory is usually kind of the, I'm going to set the stage for who this character is and what's about to happen and why it's about to happen. Well, you can really, you know, that's a common strategy, and it's an important strategy as a part of a fictional story, but it's also something that people have a tendency, especially if they're an amateur, to go overboard. You know, they feel the need to really give you almost the entire history of the character and the reason why they're a jerk or the reason why they're really nice and sweet and an easy pushover and so on and so forth. And you just have to be careful to not get carried away, because all of a sudden you get the reader gets drugged down and kind of bored with reading this backstory and looking, you know, ready for something to happen that actually engages them in the story. Loose sentence structure is another very common mistake. I mean, the way that we talk is extremely loose, and amateur writers have a tendency to write the way they talk, and you really have to look at every time when you're looking at your writing. You want to ask yourself, is there a way for me to be able to communicate what I've just written in a more concise manner? And if you kind of have that mindset as you're kind of revising your own work, you'll definitely find that you'll discover there's a lot of loose sentence structure that's a very common mistake. There's also the use of passive sentence construction instead of proactive and active construction. So rather than saying, you literally could spend almost a whole show about each of these, but just a quick example, would be, saying that instead of talking about something and somebody doing something, instead of saying this person did this, or this was done to this person, that's passive, versus this person did this to the other person, that's more active. Introduction, real kind of strange introduction of characters, a character just suddenly showing up and not really having any kind of transition into the character's development and involvement in the story, that's a common mistake. starting stories in the wrong place. I actually have a client that I've been working with recently that I was really, they had already had their book published, and they, said that they were wanted to, I won't say their name because you know them, and I don't want to I'll protect the guilty, but they came to me and said that they wanted to me to help them market their book and were ready to pay a reasonable publicity fee, and yet they wanted me to take a look at it and give them my opinion, and I had to say, honestly, I've looked at it and it starts off with really a lot of backstory at the very beginning. And it takes a couple of chapters to get into the book before you really start to go, wow, this is a really good story. It's really engaging and catches your attention, but it doesn't happen until about the third chapter. And I told him, I said, man, unfortunately, I don't see this book doing very well because you started your story at the wrong place. You need to capture people's attention immediately from the beginning. It has to engage them and pull them into where they're wanting more, and then you have to keep them on the edge of their seat the entire time with exciting, unrolling story that just involves you in every aspect of it. And that's a very common mistake that people make as well.
Todd, we're starting to run out of time now. And by the way, because there's a couple of other points that I want to make sure that the audience hears. So when you're back next week, let's make sure that we get those other points in. Website we can find you at?
ThePublishingGuru.com is my blog. It has more than 300 articles on writing, publishing, and marketing books. There's a 24-hour recording on there, The Truth About Self-Publishing. If you're considering self-publishing, you'll definitely want to hear that because you'll be shocked by some of the things that I reveal about the industry. Ask thepublishingguru.com. That's the way to go.
Yeah, and by the way, one other thing very quickly about one of the authors, and I know you know her, the one that said, don't worry about it. You just sign it and you'll know what it is after it passes. Actually.
I forgot to try to work Nancy Pelosi into this.
Somehow, I know. I got you. Okay, I'll talk to you later. Thanks. I'll see you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Welcome back. Psychologist Amy Wood with us. She's the author of Life Your Way. She graduated from Loyola University in New Orleans in 1985 with a communications degree, then enjoyed an invigorating advertising, marketing, and publishing career in Chicago. Fascinated by corporate dynamics and human behavior, she enrolled in Chicago's Adler School of Professional Psychology at the age of 30 to become a psychologist. And she fell in love with Maine after completing her clinical internship at the University of Maine Counseling Center and launched her practice in Portland in 2000. Amy's also certified by the College of Executive Coaching in California and is known for her workshops and presentations on the themes of her book. And let's say, Amy Wood, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Life Your Way, Refresh Your Approach to Success and Breathe Easier in a Fast-Paced World. Where do people get stuck, Amy? And when I say get stuck, everybody wants to breathe. Everybody wants to relax. But most people are in that very fast-paced, microwavable world, and they can't seem to get anywhere.
Right. I think where people get stuck is that they have so many ideas for things that they want to do. There are so many self-help books out there, so many advertisements for coaches, so many blogs you can read. I mean, I can go on and on and on. There's just so much out there distracting us with all of these messages about ways that we can grow and ways we can improve ourselves professionally and personally. And where people get stuck is they feel overwhelmed with all the information. They don't know what to do first. They don't know how to get things done because there's so much they have to do. And they don't even know if they really want to change. They just think they do because they keep getting that message.
Interesting point with the title, Life Your Way, and what you just said about all the self-help books and all the people are telling you how to live life, how to be happy, how to have joy, etc. And I think what they're missing, and you've caught it here, what they're missing is the bridge to do what we're, or being, not do, but being what we're talking about here. It starts internally and recognizing what you are inside and then externalizing it.
Right, exactly. Instead of the other way around, you know, you can't go anywhere today. Let's say you go to the supermarket and immediately you see all these magazine covers in the magazine rack looking at you with messages like, reinvent yourself by Friday, have, do, and be it all in 10 easy steps, get the perfect body by Friday, etc. And people are, you know, overwhelmed with these messages so much, they don't really know what they want internally because they don't take the time to really get away from all those messages and listen to their inner voice. And that takes time and space and practice.
It's interesting to look at also, yes, we have that inner voice, and yes, that it gets clouded over by all of these massive amounts of messages we get hit with. But the key is, and I think the word definition really comes down to it, somebody has a goal, whatever that goal is, and they're defining the goal, but not what the goal truly means to them. And it's not the goal they're working on. It's that emotional definition of the goal that's hidden deep down within them. And usually the two things are different, and they never accomplish what they set out.
Right. Because really, in the end, what we're all looking for is to feel good. That's a goal we all have. And there are many different routes to feeling good, and there are a lot of messages out there in the world about what it will take to make us feel good, but only we know the answer to that individually. It's different for all of us. You know, for one person it could be, you know, getting a job in a big city and working 60 hours a week. That could feel good. For someone else, it might be living out in the country. I mean, those are two extreme examples, but there's a lot of variance there, you know, and you have to really spend some time with yourself to know what is it that's going to make me feel good, because that really translates into success. It's not someone else's version that's going to make you feel successful. It's doing what your inner voice is telling you you really need to do if you want to just feel good about yourself and have peace of mind.
You see, but if I listen to my inner voice, I may not be what you want me to be. And I think that in and of itself
is
amazing for a lot of people.
Right.
So it's give yourself permission to, that's an interesting word, the P word, permission. Most people are looking for permission to feel good. And the permission is in the mirror, but we don't want to take the responsibility for making that decision.
Right. And we don't really have to, because there are so many expert opinions everywhere we look. You know, there are so many books out there, and there's so much information on the internet, you know, on how we can have the life we really want, that we don't even know what it is because we don't take the time to ask ourselves.
Yeah, and that's a scary thing. And isn't it a learning process? We've learned to take in and perceive information in a certain way. And I've always felt that if you learn, you can unlearn, and then you can relearn whatever alternative it is. But you got to make that decision to want to do it. And I think at the end result, at the very bottom, at base, we look for emotional satisfaction and what the different things mean. And the emotional satisfaction, you said it, could be 100 different things to 100 different people, but in the end result, what is it that's going to cause us to be emotionally satisfied?
That's right. And there's so many suggestions out there. You know, the world has never been more open to change and personal transformation, and that's a wonderful thing. But what's happened is we've gone from, let's say when I was growing up in the 70s, where you really had to search out opportunities because we just had mainstream offerings. For example, I grew up in Canada. We had 3 TV stations to choose from. Now there are hundreds. You know, the challenge used to be trying to find information, trying to uncover the truth. And now there's so much information, the challenge has changed from finding information to sorting it all through and getting rid of what you don't need and focusing on what is right for you. And again, that takes you getting away from it all and getting perspective, really going within and asking, you know, do I really need all of these gadgets at home, you know, technologically? Do I really need all these expert opinions? Do I really need to read all of these self-help books in a stack in my bedroom? You know, and maybe you don't, maybe you do, but only you have the answer, and that really takes some soul-searching to find out.
Oh, and there's a lot of push-pull in that, especially with the high-tech, the technology that we're in today, the texting and the this and the that. I think one of the things that it's done, Amy, it's taken away from the human contact, the human touch, that connection, and all of a sudden it's, you know, it's on a computer, it's on an iPhone, it's a BlackBerry, it's a something. And that, I mean, technology, for what it is wonderful, but we haven't made that distinction between technology and humanity.
That's right. And I'm glad you mentioned that technology really is wonderful. You know, there are a lot of books out there that talk about how all of the technology is creating nothing but, you know, clutter in our lives and confusion and distraction. And that's true if there's too much of it. You know, just like if you eat too much fattening food, it's not good for you. But that doesn't mean you have to toss out all fattening food. That doesn't mean you have to toss out all of technology or everything on the internet. And what I talk about in my book is how you need to embrace all of this, the fast pace and all of the options and the technology and all the rest of it, and decide of all of this, all of these wonderful choices, what's right for me and what can I just say no to because it's not me. That's what's going to make your life more calm, and that's what's going to give you peace of mind, not rejecting it all.
Now, by the way, I have your book in front of me, and I think chapter 1 really says it all. It could sum up everything that we've talked about so far. It's called Get Perspective, and that's really where the key is. We don't have perspective. There's so much going on at one time. It's very hard to be mindful and to really define what it is that you want, who you are, why you are, and what your purpose is in this life.
That's right. Yeah, we've lost perspective. And what we do, we tend to go overboard with all of this stuff, you know, to the point where we're constantly you know, buying books and looking at websites and getting new information, and we're busy all the time, and we don't have even a break in our day to even look at ourselves and say, what do I really want? Or we go the other way and we say, you know what, I'm just going to do yoga and I'm going to meditate and I'm not going to take part in this. And both of those approaches cause problems because they're not really based on reality. So when I say, you know, get perspective, that really means accept the fact that you're living in America, and America has always been fast-paced. It has always been about getting information and about uncovering new ideas and moving forward and progress and all the rest of it. And that's where we've been since we landed here over 200 years ago, and it's not going to get any slower. So the idea here is not to try to manage it all or try to slow it all down or escape from it. The solution really is to say, you know, this is great. I'm like a kid in a candy store. So what pieces of candy do I really want out of all this? And what can I just say no to? That's the challenge.
And by the way, it's called, I'll use the R word now, it's taking the responsibility for your own emotions. We live in a blame-based society. If I'm not having a good time, it's your fault. It couldn't be my fault. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that no matter what you do, in the end result, what happens to you is going to be not your responsibility because it happened. There could be extenuating circumstances, but how you deal with it, how you feel about it, that's all up to you. And based on that perspective in and of itself, by itself, allows you to be or not be.
Right. And that's why I say, you know, in one of the chapters that it's very important if you want to thrive amid the overwhelm and the fast pace, it's very essential that you'd be an optimist, which is what you're talking about, you know, looking at life and saying, you know, there's some things I'm really not happy with. You know, maybe you got laid off, or maybe someone broke up with you, or you don't look the way you want to. But to go beyond that and say, you know what, this is my life, and I'm going to make the best of it. So I'm going to accept reality. I'm going to accept that, you know, everything isn't exactly how I want it, and I'm going to make my life the best it can be today. I mean, that's really, out of all the people I've studied who are the most successful, and by successful I mean people are really happy with themselves and their life.
Sure.
What those people say, there's a common theme here that they, at the end of the day, they look at the day they just lived and they say, what went well today? What do I want to keep for tomorrow? And what do I want to try differently? And it's a practice. And that's a key message of my book, that life is not about perfection. It's not about a one-shot, like you said, microwavable solution. It's practicing every day, doing the best that you can, applying certain principles over and over again, knowing that you're going to have some bad days because things always aren't always going to go your way. There's certain things you cannot control internally and externally.
Well, let's touch on something for a moment, that word perfection. And I think that in and of itself needs a definition. If you go to the dictionary, the definition of perfection is the highest form of function. And I believe very strongly that we are perfect every day, and the reason for that is this. The moment you fall out of that category of perfect is when I try to be, if I try to be Amy at my absolute optimum, my best Amy would, I can only be the second best you. There's no way I can be better at being Amy than Amy is. So if I become the best Michael Ray that I can be, then all of a sudden I am perfect for who I am, and if I just stop trying to be somebody else or what somebody else wants me to be, then all of a sudden that word perfection happens. Dealing with difficult people. One of the things that I've learned over the years, that people who like themselves like other people who like themselves. People who don't like themselves like other people who don't like themselves. So you've got a bond there. People who like themselves do not like people who don't like themselves, and vice versa. And if you happen to like yourself and you walk into a room, and we've all done it, you get that feeling there's that somebody in that room that does not like you, and you can feel it, and you try to do everything you possibly can to get them to like you, I think that's when perfection goes right down the tubes. Just to realize it's got nothing to do with you. It's got to do with their attitude towards you.
That's right.
Based
that's
on them.
Yeah. Right. And even if you do everything right, you're not going to be likable to everybody.
No.
So, you know, that's why I say you've really got to let go of certain things you can't control, because otherwise it's just going to stress you out. And that's part of the challenge of living in this fast-paced world, is there are a lot of things that are distracting you all day long and rushing you. And so wherever you can, you've got to make a choice to say, you know what, I can't control this. I can only control so much. And if you let go of the things you can't have any jurisdiction over, your life is going to be better. And one of those things is whether or not people like you. You know, even the most likable people in the world have enemies.
Now, here, let me ask you this. Ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. No, see, absolutely, absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. And I think that's
right.
Really the key. If I had the ability, if I had five women standing in front of me right now looking at me, and Amy, if I had the ability to walk behind each one and look through their eyes, I would see five different Michael Rays. Some of them I'm going to be hideous to. Some of them I'm going to be so gorgeous they could never say no, no matter what they did. So what am I going to do? Try to please everybody? Absolutely not. I can't. So I'm only going to please the people who are pleased by me. The other ones, it's never going to happen no matter what I do. So am I good looking?
That's
you bet I am. Somebody out there thinks I'm gorgeous and somebody else doesn't. And if they don't, somebody else will.
Right. And think of what your life would be like if everyone thought you were gorgeous. It would be pretty stressful, wouldn't it?
How's this? Yes, it is.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
it would
you
be.
Would know.
Yeah, no question about it.
But yes, you can only be who you are. And when you're trying to please everyone, let's say, and let's give a real world example here, let's say that you really want to find a job and you hear that it's very competitive because of the economy not being good right now. So you're trying to get your resume to look better than everyone else's and you're working three jobs to try to get experience that other people might have that you don't, you're going to end up wearing yourself out. And how are you going to appear when you finally do get that interview you really want? Someone's going to look across their desk at you and think this person is completely worn out. They're not capable of being effective in the working world, and they probably don't have very much confidence. So what I say is, you know, decide what you can do to be the best person you can be. Because if you go comparing yourself all the time to others, you can't win. And you're just going to deplete yourself.
Yeah, but Amy,
and ask
yourself, which candidate do I want to be?
Do I want to be the person who's worn out interviewing for a job and looking like they don't have any confidence? Or do I want to be the person who looks like they have a balanced life and they have perspective on things?
Did you by chance see the last Rocky movie, Sylvester Stallone?
I don't think I saw the last one. I saw, I think, the first one.
Yeah, the last one had something in it that made a lot of sense. The son was concerned because the son was losing his identity because Rocky was Rocky. And they walked outside the restaurant. Rocky finally had bought a restaurant. They walked outside the restaurant, and the kid told him basically he's having a terrible life because of him. And what he said, what Stallone said, really left an impact. And he said, basically, life's tough. Life is the hardest thing that you'll ever run into. It's going to knock you down. It's going to try to keep you down. It's going to beat you up. But you see, it's not how hard you hit that proves how tough you are. It's how hard you can get hit and get up and keep moving. And that's realistically, Amy, what life is about. You're going to get hit. No matter what you do, somebody's going to knock you down some way. But it's the idea
to
have the ability to get up.
Right. And I think that one of the ways that a lot of self-help advice falls short today is that they don't tell you that. You know, there's many books out there that will say if you just follow these five steps, your life will be bliss. And what they don't tell you is that even if you do all that, you're still going to have curveballs in life. And the truth really is, though, if you apply some of the principles that I talk about, you know, in my book, like being an optimist or learning to get along well with other people or learning how to manage your life within the amount of time you have, that sort of thing, there are 24 principles. If you do that, you're not going to, you know, get through scot-free, you know, not have any problems. But it'll be easier. You'll have less drama in your life. You'll have less crises. You'll probably be more successful than you would be otherwise. So, again, the reason that I wrote this book is I wanted to provide people with just a practical way to thrive in a world that is pretty complex. And I'm not offering the world here. I'm not offering people the moon. I'm not saying, you know, if you just read my book, you'll never have any problems again. Because when you have a book like that, what happens is you read it and you say, wow, I'm so excited. It's such a great book. But you get to the end and you can't sustain it. And then you think, wow, I guess I just read the wrong book. I better get another one. And you're constantly reading and constantly getting new information and consulting new experts because you're not getting the truth, which is, you know, there are plenty of great philosophies for living a good life, but you've got to stick to one of them and you've got to practice it. And there's got to be room for error.
By the way, I mean, no question about that. Now, is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, I'm at Amy Wood, PSYD, which is PSYD.com. So it's Amy Wood, P as in Peter, S as in Sam, Y, D as in David, .com. And that's Doctor of Psychology is what PSYD means. And you
Wonderful.
Can order the book there. Any bookstore can get it for you, or you can go to Amazon and order it there. And if you go to my website, I do have a blog. It's called Life My Way. And what I do with this blog is I walk my talk. So I take the information in the book, all the principles that I teach, and I show you how I'm actually using these principles in my life. And I show you pretty clearly that I'm not always perfect. You know, I do make my own mistakes, and I keep trying, just like you do.
No question about it. By the way, mistakes are there, and I think every mistake in and of itself is a treasure, because look what you get to learn, and you grow, and you get larger and larger, and then one day you can be as large as life if you want to be, or larger than. Amy, thank
That's
you so
right.
much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night.
For you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Take it back now.
For now and evermore. That's all.
Peter Sims with us. He's the author of Little Bets, How Breakthrough Ideas Emerge from Small Discoveries. He's the co-author with Bill George of the Wall Street Journal and Business Week best-selling book, True North. His writings has appeared in the Harvard Business Review, Fortune, and TechCrunch. And he's a contributor to the Reuters and Harvard Business Review blogs. He received his MBA from Stanford University. And he's had several classmates establish a popular course on leadership. And he's been a long time in collaboration with faculty at Stanford's Hasso Plattner Institute for Design. And let us say, Peter, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Great to hear. Thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk about little bets, how breakthrough ideas emerge from small discoveries. Have we stopped that creativity? Because if you really think about it, everything that we've done in this country, and it's emerged around the world eventually, that just these little breakthrough ideas, that little aha epiphany moment, and billions of dollars have been made from it. Is it still here, or do we have to search for it now?
Well, I mean, it's very rare that instantaneous ideas come to people. And so Mozart was an exception to that. You know, he could come up with a symphony in his mind, but most of the time it's like Thomas Edison would work 9,000 experiments to get to a light bulb. And it's very similar when you look at how a lot of the great companies in this country have come about, whether it's Google or Starbucks, which started as a kind of ripoff on Italian cafes, but then evolved into what it's become today. I mean, the first Starbucks had no menus written in English. They were in Italian. They had no chairs. It was very different than what we experience today. So the point is they had to make a lot of mistakes to become what they became.
There was a book that I did an interview on years ago, and the book was called Borrow from Brilliance. And basically, That's really what it is. We've got into our world today. There's almost nothing that's brand new. Everything seems to be a derivative of something. And it's that little bit of an idea. How do we twist it? How do we take it off in this direction and really make something compelling out of it? And I think that in and of itself, I know I asked the question a different way, but I believe that's still here. It's just that instant recognition of what it is that can be different. And I think it happens so fast, Peter, without even sitting down and studying. It's that aha moment that's got to do it.
Well, I think I partially agree with you. I don't totally agree with you. I think there are moments where we come up with an insight and say, oh, okay, that connects two dots and you're solving a new problem. But most of the time it takes a lot of trial and error and a lot of persistence to get to that point. And to build upon lots and lots of very small ideas. So in the case of Google, it started off as a project to improve library searches. And once Larry Page and Sergey Brin were able to solve that problem of prioritizing which books should show up first in a web search, then they took that and applied it to the broader information search online. And then they had to figure out, well, how are they going to make money? So they had to then piece together a revenue model over time. And so these very small steps allowed them to piece together what ultimately became quite an innovative and you know, hugely innovative company, but a brilliant idea.
And so you just take it out a little piece at a time is really what you're saying.
Well, my point is just that when you're trying to, when we take a step back and look at a brilliant idea or something that's a breakthrough, it can be, you know, in any type of breakthrough, it be science, art, it can be in business. The point is that it's often the result of a lot of different small pieces that have been put together, not something that just came together instantaneously. So Chris Rock, when we see the comedian Chris Rock on HBO, his routines are brilliant and flawless. But to get there, to get to 60 minutes of material that's going to be fresh, he's had to go through 6 months to a year in small clubs, trying out night after night, lots and lots of ideas, most of which fail. Lots of these little bets, as I call them,
sure.
Achievable actions that he's willing to take in order to discover a routine that's going to be fresh.
So he takes all the little bets out of the routines that he's tried in the small clubs that some worked, some didn't work, took the
right
ones that worked, combined them together, and then he had a successful act.
Right. He's iterated constantly, night after night after night. So one night he may see a part of a joke about Walmart that works, and then the next night he'll go back and build on that. And the next night he'll go back and build on that, and he has to get the opening down, the transitions down, the closing down, all those jokes down, and it just takes an enormous amount of this iteration to get there. It's not something that just comes to him, pops in his head. So I think that's one of the myths that I'm hoping to dispel with this book. And then the other thing is just that people use a process. They use a set of methods, whether it's Frank Gehry, the architect designing new buildings, or Chris Rock, or people who are expert entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs or the founders of Google. They use an approach that's very much discovery-oriented. And so that's what we can all learn to do better, and that's really what this book is about.
So, okay, so the essence then, the approach is, it's not a process, but it's discovery-oriented. You
right.
Plot and you work on something that, let's say, has low risk, and you move
right.
And you get something better, and you get something better, and then pretty
right.
Soon you tie it together and then open it up.
That's core part of it is using a little bit to discover, and it's just a concrete action that anyone can take to discover whether it's doing something new at work or in your personal life. Dating is an example of a little bit in your personal life. But there are also different methods that people can use to do this more effectively. For example, they can go out and ask a lot of questions and really immerse into the world to find new ideas. This is where the best ideas exist, by really observing how people are reacting to different things, or you know, just getting out of your office to see where new opportunities lie. So what Chris Rock will do is he'll go out and just observe carefully to try to find material like the Walmart material or how people are interacting in their relationships. And then from that, he's able to piece together these little bets that he then goes and iterates. So there are a number of these methods that any of us can use to be a little bit more creative.
Okay, so in essence, what we're dealing with is looking at something and just moving through. Again, I want to repeat it because it's important, because it could be from a business to a relationship to anything. Find the little things that work. Now, was there an overarching theme that you found to really get to the point where you say that this has got to be it? I want to do some changes here. What were the themes that caused you to come back to this was it?
Good question. Well, one of the most important things is that when people are making these small bets, they identify problems and opportunities as they go. So, you know, going back to the case of Google, they realized they were solving an important problem because people needed to search for information online. But they were solving a problem on a very small scale. People were doing library searches. And so they took that basic approach and they applied it to a much larger problem. And I think that was their aha moment. They said, wow, we've created this algorithm that we can use to address a much larger need. And I think the same is true for the way Chris Rock would work. He nails something one night in a small club with 30 people, and it sort of takes off, and he says, wow, I've got something here that he then can take and test in a number of other environments and eventually on the big stage. And so, yeah, you just need to look for those moments where you've found a really unique new problem or new opportunity and then build on that.
Now, by the way, you've also talked about a neuroscience research that you've done, and it has to do with that little bit of a click also, that little bit of a recognition of something that causes it to happen, releasing those chemicals that are going to say, this is where I want to be, this will work.
That's right. Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, we, by our nature, when we're adults, we tend to self-censor our ideas. We tend to judge our ideas very quickly, and what the neuroscience research has shown is that if we can just allow ourselves to be a little bit more playful, that reduces that barrier to coming up with a new idea, coming up with a new possibility. Again, you just want to come up with possibilities that you can go out and test in the world, right? Whether it's just scribbling ideas down on a piece of paper that you bounce off your friends, your coworkers, or just people you trust. And so the neuroscience research is very powerful in saying if you can learn to improvise, that releases that part of your mind that can be so self-critical. And so that's where improvisation techniques come in, accepting every offer, taking things that other people give you, taking your own ideas and not judging them too quickly before you've had a chance to let them develop a little bit.
Yeah, because a judgment in and of itself will be a defense mechanism. It's that old adage that laughter is the best medicine. What truly happens when you laugh is your brain releases endorphins, and then from the feel good part of your mind or your brain, and then all of a sudden you feel good, and whatever you hear and you see at the time, you resonate to it, and you're enjoying yourself, and you don't have the rest of your mind saying don't do that because you're going to get hurt.
Right. Exactly. And we need to give ourselves permission to come up with those ideas early, and there's these methods that they use at Pixar, where they're creating a new film at Pixar, and they will basically say, well, if you've come up with an initial idea for how, let's say, Woody's hair should look, if we're talking about a Toy Story movie, if somebody's come up with an idea for how the hair should look for Woody in one of those movies, the director will not immediately say, well, that's not a good idea. Even if the director thinks that the idea could be much improved, they'll say, well, I like that starting point, and what if we did this? So they build on the ideas. They call this plussing. And again, it's an approach that can be learned. Any of us can use as we're developing ideas with our coworkers or our family or our friends.
Okay, let me tell you what I'm hearing. Let me paraphrase this a bit. The difference, let's say, between a little bet and a big bet. And you said with the neurosciences, with the big bet, you're going to defense out, and you may logically say, I don't think this is going to work. Somebody's not going to like it, and I'm going to get judged by yada, yada, yada. So if you go to the little bet, your mind will allow you to move through that, accomplish it, and then add something else to it. So what you're really doing is using your own mind against itself to get what you want.
Yeah, you're giving your own mind permission to be able to do something that's new and creative without taking risk, right? With doing something that's achievable and affordable. And therefore, you're increasing your odds of being able to piece together a number of different ideas or insights and possibilities to seize on a new opportunity. The way Chris Rock would with a joke, he fails most of the time when he's throwing these new ideas out in clubs, but he's willing to bomb in front of these small audiences because he's only in front of 30 to 40 people. He doesn't want to bomb when he's on HBO. I mean, that would be a big bet where he's really bombing.
Sure.
And so it's like creating these environments where we can just try a lot of things and learn and then take with those learnings out to a much larger stage.
Now, by the way, this happens with every author, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be. there comes that time in the writing where there is your own epiphany, your own aha moment, when you realize there's a dimension of the subject matter broader than what you thought it would be. You learn something that you didn't know you were going to learn. Where was that for you?
Yeah, it did hit me in this case for sure, and that is I studied how these different creators and innovators work. So I interviewed over 200 people, whether it was stand-up comedians or expert entrepreneurs or Frank Gehry or people in the military who are doing strategy for counterinsurgency over in the Middle East. And what really surprised me and struck me was how similar they thought, how similar their work processes were if you actually looked inside at how they actually work. And they would use similar expressions like the importance of using constraints when you're doing something new and not allowing yourself to go in too many different directions. They would talk about framing and reframing problems as they went. And I just found that to be amazing, and they found it to be eerie, that somebody like Frank Gehry, who's an architect in Los Angeles, would think like a general in the military working in Afghanistan, but they truly do. They use very, very similar methods and processes.
Sure, and I really believe when it really comes down to it, at base of all the methods, all the processes, it says, don't fight yourself. And I want to repeat this because I think it's an important point to make. Don't fight yourself. You have processes within your own brain that will trigger if you're being, quote unquote, attacked in some way, emotional, physically,
right,
intellectual, whatever the case may be. So
the key
is to move around them, work with them, and get right up to that point where you know that they're not going to hit yet, back off, and then add something else to it. And what you're really doing is calming your mind and allowing your mind to know that within the project itself, you're safe.
Absolutely. You've summed up the psychological and neuroscience barriers that can prevent people from doing things that are creative very well. And so the antidotes that I present in the book look at research, such as the research on play, or the research from Dr. Carol Dweck, who's a professor at Stanford of social psychology, who's looked at how different people react to setbacks and failure. And what her conclusion is, based on decades of research, and it's extremely well-respected research right now, very cutting edge, is she says that people can either have a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. Okay, and we all tend towards one of these two, have elements of both, but a fixed mindset would be, for example, Dweck describes John McEnroe, where anytime he felt threatened by failure or setback, he would blame everyone in sight for problems, the line judge, the crowds, what have you. And therefore, he's very reluctant to try anything that's outside of his comfort zone. People with a fixed mindset are overly concerned with titles and status and are really afraid of failure. Growth mindset-oriented people would be more like Dweck describes Michael Jordan as someone with a growth mindset. They focus much more on effort as opposed to the external title or success or failure of an undertaking. They focus much more on learning and expanding their capabilities. So they don't see their talent as fixed. They see it as expanding constantly. So if Michael Jordan didn't shoot three-pointers well, he learned how to do that. He was able to grow his game, right? And this, according to Dweck, can be developed. This growth mindset can be developed. And it just takes, number one, recognizing what mindset we tend towards, and then putting ourselves in situations where we're doing things that are maybe a little bit outside of our comfort zone, but are growing our comfort with the fact that if you just exert more effort into something, you're more likely to be successful. And so, that's the psychological lens that this book looks through. And again, this research has been extremely well received across a whole bunch of different sectors. And it's I think, exactly what Chris Rock would do. He just persists and is resilient as he goes through these small failures. He's not putting himself out there in a big failure, as you say.
No question about it. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Peter Sims, do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Hey, well, thanks for asking. It's www.petersims.com. The book is available everywhere now. It just came out. It's on Amazon. But at my website, there's a free excerpt to the book if people are interested. And again, that's just www.petersims.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Peter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Oh, I'm going to fall down. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And as a matter of fact, if there is a subject that you'd like to hear addressed on the show, someone you'd like to hear interviewed, contact Radio Susie. You can find her on the homepage of the website. And as a matter of fact, all of the guests and the schedules are on the homepage. And if you missed any, missed her book, missed the website, or any contact information, just get a hold of Radio Susie. It looks like Radio Susie, the guest, has not shown up. So we're going to call the guest and see what happens from there. And by the way, realistically, we're going to get a chat room up pretty soon. And also there's phone numbers that you can call in. And if you missed a particular show, you can go right to BBS Radio and get it up, get a podcast of the show. So that's easy enough to do. We are looking at all of the things that it takes to become a culture and a society. One of the biggest problems that we have had today, more than any other time in our history, is that we don't have commonality of definition, and I can't repeat that enough. Too many people think a particular subject or a particular way of looking at things are so different. And if we started to think, when I say think alike, that doesn't mean that we're going to get stamped out of a mold and become automatons, but if we started to define the culture, whatever that means, the culture, if we define the culture in a certain way, if we define America in a certain way, if we define women in a certain way, men in a certain way, and the different ethnicities and gender, whatever the case may be, if we all have a commonality of definition where we know we've got something to anchor to and to work with, that would solve a tremendous amount of the problems that we have right now. We are so diversely divided today because of how we think, quote-unquote, things should be. And this has caused a major problem for the most part with the country in and of itself. And as a matter of fact, it's not just the country. It happens to be in the world. So if we can really take a look at what's going on today, taking a look at what a relationship means, and if you don't think you should define a relationship, then go ask the 55-60% of the people who get divorced in the first year. You ask them what the problem is and why they're not married after a year and a half. Because we don't know going in. And one of the reasons that we don't know, we take things for granted. We assume things. And think about the assumption. Who was it? Famous psychologist. It'll come. I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember who it was. But basically said, an assumption will draw an incontestable conclusion for the most part. You take it on as fact. And the problem there is the fact now becomes the truth. And if you take an assumption on as your truth, all of a sudden you're going through the world and you're not facing the reality of what's out there in front of you, and you fall down a lot. So don't assume anything. Don't even assume that somebody that you're with, you know exactly what they want, how they want it, and how they want to be talked to. There's a very simple solution to it. It's called ask. And if you like what you hear, stay. If you don't like what you hear, very simple, leave. There is the key. You don't have to be somebody else for somebody else. This thing about being yourself is a very tough thing for most people. It's called be who you are. It's okay, and you can give yourself permission to be. Too many people here running around looking for approval from someone else when approval really starts deep down. It starts with you, and it starts with how you experience yourself, how you feel about yourself, and how you want to be.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking.
Let me put that another way. Sow a thought and you reap an act. For thinking or impulse precedes action. Listen to it. Sow an act and you'll reap a habit. And our habits spring from our repeated acts and thoughts. Sow a habit and you reap a character. And for a character is the result of our habits, our thinking, and our doing. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. And in this way, in the thinking and acting of everyday life, we form ourselves and we shape our destiny.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Ted Nugent wrote something that I thought was interesting. It's kind of a plain in your face and refreshing on an occasion. Now, Nugent wrote it, and I think you should take a very strong look and a listen to what it was. Now, as a matter of fact, Nugent, if you don't know, he's a rock singer, he's a hunter, he's a naturalist. And when he heard California Senator Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein denounce him for being a gun owner and a rock star, this was his response after telling the senators about the past contribution to children's charities and the scholarship foundations, which had totaled more than $13.7 million in the last probably 10 years now. And this is what Nugent said. Nugent said, I'm a bad America. I'm a bad American. This pretty much sums it up for me. I like big trucks. I like big boats, big houses, and naturally pretty women. I believe the money that I make belongs to me and my family, not from mid-level governmental functionary with a bad comb over who wants to give it away to crack addicts squirting out babies. I don't care about appearing compassionate. I think playing with my toy guns doesn't make me a killer. I believe ignoring your kids and giving them Prozac at night, I think this is the wrong way to go. I think I'm doing better than the homeless. I think being a minority makes you noble or victimized. I have the right not to be tolerant of others if they're different, weird, or make me mad. This is my life to live, not necessarily up to others' expectations. I know what sex is, and we're not varying degrees of it. I don't celebrate Kwanzaa, but if you want to, that's fine. I just don't feel like everybody else should have to. I believe that if you're selling me a Dairy Queen shake, a pack of cigarettes, a hotel room, you do it in English. And as a matter of fact, if you're an American citizen, you should speak English. My uncles and forefathers shouldn't have had to die in vain so that you can leave the country you were born to come here and disrespect ours and make us bend to your will. Get over it. I think the cops have every right to shoot your sorry butt if you're running from them. After all, if they've only told you to stop. If you can't understand the word freeze or stop in English, see the previous line. I don't use the excuse, it's the children as a shield for unpopular opinions and actions. I know how to count votes. I feel much safer letting a machine do it with no political affiliation, do the recount when needed. I know the definition of what lying is, and it isn't based on the word is ever. I don't think just because you're not born in this country, you're qualified for any special loan programs, government-sponsored bank loans, etc. So you can open up a hotel, a 7-Eleven, a trinket shop, or anything else with the indigenous peoples can't get past a high school education because they can't afford it. I don't like the initiative of inventing the internet. I thought the Taco Bell dog was funny. I want them to bring back safe and sane fireworks. Believe no one ever died because of something Ozzy Osbourne, Ice-T, or Marilyn Manson sang. And that doesn't mean that I want to listen to the crap from someone else's car when I'm stopped at a red light, but I respect their right to. And I think that being a student doesn't give you any more enlightenment than working at Blockbuster or Jack in the Box. I don't want to eat or I don't want to drink anything with the words light, fat-free, or anything else on the package. Our soldiers did not go to some foreign country to risk their lives in vain and defend our Constitution so that decades later you can tell me it's a living document, ever-changing, and is open to interpretation. The guys who wrote it were light years ahead of anyone today, and they meant what they said. Now leave the document alone or there's going to be trouble. I don't hate the rich. I help the poor, and I know wrestling is fake. I never owned or was a slave, and a large percentage of our forefathers weren't wealthy. They weren't wealthy enough to own one either. So please stop blaming me because some prior white people were idiots. And remember, tons of white, Indian, Chinese, and other races have been enslaved too. It was wrong for everyone. It was wrong for every one of them. That was Ted Nugent, and let's go to our guest. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jane Bernard with us, fine-tuning, connecting with your inner power. And as a matter of fact, she's with us right now. She lives in New York City. Her degree is in philosophy, the New School for Social Research, special education. And 3 decades of informal Zen practice form the foundation for Jane's uniquely accessible perspective on intuition and intuitive eating. Let us say, Jane, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Intuitiveness. What is intuitiveness? We've all heard the word, and most people get confused when they hear it.
Right. Well, intuition is actually our sixth sense. It's a form of being alert. Our intuition is our internal GPS.
Okay, so okay, go ahead.
What it does is it coordinates the information we're getting from our 5 senses, and it balances that with what we know in our mind from experience and what we feel in our heart to get a clear perspective and to be really alert in the moment.
Okay, so effectively, when we talk about intuitive eating, that's being aware of what you're eating and the effect that that food's going to have on you.
Yes, but it's much more than that. It's really being aware of how you feel. Intuition, because it's connected, it's a sense, and it connects our senses, keeps us in touch with our bodies. And if you tune into your body, you're going to have a much better idea of how hungry you are and what you feel like eating. In our culture, we have a tendency to blame the food on our weight. But the reality is that it's not what we're eating, it's that we're not tuned in to our bodies.
Okay, so effectively, and I got that. Now, but let me ask the question, what's the first step in tuning into your body? That's something that people hear all the time, but is it that easy to do?
It actually is, and the first step in tuning into your body is realizing that you're not tuning into your 5 senses. The first step is to start really seeing what's in front of you and hearing what's being said to you and feeling what you're touching. It's really a tuning in to your 5 senses that connects you with your little voice, your intuition.
Go ahead.
What's an example? An example would... would be if you're not walking, if you're walking down the street and you're not looking where you're going, you go the wrong way, or you can bump into a wall. If you're not listening to what some, please ask me what you're going to say.
Oh, that's okay. They're going to fix it next week, but there's like a couple second delay, so that's why we're kind of, we may stumble over each other once in a while. That's what the problem is.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, and so it's not you and I. It's the phones, and they're going to fix that in a week. Now to go beyond that, so it's really what I'm hearing you say, Jane. It's called being mindful, being aware, paying attention, which most people don't do because of this fast-paced life that we live in, that it's so confusing for most people, we don't take the time to think about it.
Oh, that's a really good point, Michael. And confusion is the opposite of clarity. So when we're confused, we're not really creating our lives, and we're not even controlling ourselves. We're instead just trying to fit into the puzzle of stress and our physical world. Whereas when you start tuning into your intuition, you actually become more relaxed. And what I discovered in terms of intuitive eating is I interviewed a lot of people who were dieters and a lot of people who were what I call intuitive eaters, which are people who do not diet but are their healthy weight. And I learned that people who are intuitive eaters have 10 tools that they use automatically that make choices clear and not confusing. And an example of the one very simple one is curiosity. When a person who is an intuitive eater sits down to eat, they use their senses and their mind, and they check in with their body, and they think, oh, what do I feel like having? How hungry am I? What did I have earlier? And they use their senses to really look. Ooh, that doesn't look very good. Or, oh, that looks fresh. And they use this combination of their senses and their mind to make a spontaneous choice based on the stress they've had that day, what they have to do after their meal, and they're really in the moment. Whereas a person who is accustomed to dieting sits down to eat, they think, is this part of my diet? Not what do I want, not am I hungry for this, not how does my body feel. They think, how many calories are in this? Well, calories are very fickle. It takes more energy to burn some calories than it does to burn others. So calories are not a way to eat. The way to eat is to be real and in the moment and in tune with your hunger.
Jen, what we're really talking about also is learning to trust yourself.
Oh, boy, you hit that on the head. That's absolutely right, because to be an intuitive eater, you have to really honor and trust yourself. And one of the tools that intuitive eaters use is dignity. Dignity is a kind of self-respect. Because when you sit down to eat and you trust yourself and you listen to your body, then you don't abuse it by eating food that you don't really want or need. And another common tool that intuitive eaters use that is very hard for people who have never been an intuitive eater is prudence. Now, if you go shopping for a jacket with a friend, you're not going to necessarily try on the same jacket that he's going to try on because your taste may be different, right?
Sure.
So, therefore, if your friend is on the same diet, there's no reason for you to be on the same diet because it may not work for you. And the thing is, when people are used to dieting, they don't realize that at all times they have a choice. We are in control of ourselves. We do not have to eat as much food that is on the plate. We do not have to eat what's being served. And we can say, this is better for me or this isn't, or I'm not hungry.
Jane, let me ask you a question. And this is, by the way, I do not and have never had a weight problem. So this is mm-hmm. this isn't one of those, my friend, this is about someone else. There
okay.
are people, and I've run into this, there mm-hmm. are people who have nothing else in life, and the only thing that they get to look forward to is food. And I've met a lot of people like that. I know one person in particular that way. That mm-hmm. she's her her one high spot of the day, or every hour or so when she eats, is eating something. And she's lost a ton of weight, and she's gone through a lot of processes. But at the same time, she's a completely different woman than she was 100 pounds ago. And she's probably going to drop another 50 pounds. But the key is, in that interim period, what do you look forward to? Because when you start to lose those things, your life changes because you look at things differently. And those things that you ate because you were afraid to go out into public and be who you are now, those masks or those facades are being stripped away. Now you're out there, you're naked, you're vulnerable, and you don't know what to do. So intuitive eating is great. And by the way, I'm on board with you with that, so please hear that I am. But what do you do in a case like that when there's nothing else to look forward to?
Well, there's always something else to look forward to. And I have also worked with what I call emotional eaters. And fear and self-doubt are what drive people to eat like that. And I don't know how your friend has lost 100 pounds, but I'm happy for her. But there's a couple of different things. If you're really, if your high point in the day is your meal, then you should make it really spectacular. And more is not better. That's a myth of our material society. Quality is better. And if she really is trying genuinely to lose weight, and it sounds very admirable that she is, then she can create for herself a beautiful plate with a taste of four different things that she loves, and she can savor each one slowly and really, really enjoy it, and also enjoy the fact that she is honoring her body and giving herself the chance to be a healthy individual.
Yeah, and she went through that the banding, the stomach, one of those operations. And for her, it was great. Yeah, there comes that point when you start to strip away all of those things that protect you, then you got the problem.
Well, you don't. You don't have the problem as long as you use the intuitive tools. Now, one of the intuitive tools is patience. Patience is a way of giving yourself breathing room. Because what happens when you're in an environment where you're afraid is you freak out. And when you freak out, you don't breathe. And when you don't breathe, you don't connect with your body.
Hmm. Okay, so, and it makes sense.
Using patience, she can start to allow herself to connect with her senses. Because if she has patience and breathes and uses breathing to just feel grounded, because that's what your intuition does. It grounds you. It gives you a reality check. Then she can start to use her senses and see what she's doing with her mouth and her body.
You see, I think a very important thing that you just said, with, you know, what she did with her mouth, with her body. But the key is it's a learning response. What she's going through is a learned response. This is how she's learned to protect herself and how to act. What you're
and
saying,
a lot of people have.
Yeah, what I'm hearing you say, that if, and I'll say it in my way, let me paraphrase it, if you can learn, you can unlearn, and then you can relearn, because intuitiveness and the attitude towards that is a learned process.
It absolutely is. And the first thing you have to do is want to do it and be open to doing it. And then you have to allow yourself to do it. And one of the tools of intuitive eating is grace, which is personal forgiveness. One of the reasons why people get in the, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that people eat out of fear. Sometimes, especially for women, it's a sexual thing where they put on layers of fat to protect themselves against having sex, sex that they don't want. It's a very common thing.
It's also what sex means to them. It's not what it looks like. It's that underneath definition, it's the emotional connotation of what it is, and I think that's really what you have to get to. And with what you're saying, with you know your intuition and in the practice, it goes beyond what it looks like and it peels away the layers to what it really is, because you cannot work on a problem that you don't have. You've got to work on the problem that you have if you're going to get anywhere, and it's usually not what it looks like.
Absolutely. You got it, Michael. You totally are right. And that's what intuition does, is it connects you with yourself. It helps you to really know yourself. Because when our senses are dulled, we make the wrong connections. And when we make the wrong connections, we have confusion. And then we're not happy. And when you start using your senses, then you start recognizing what's happening. Because in reality, if you think about it, the only thing that you and I have going on for us right now, and all the listeners have, is what's happening right now, what we're hearing right now, what we're seeing right now, or what we're feeling. Everything in our brains is history. So while it's really good for any lessons we may have learned, it's not the present.
A second ago, it's history.
Pardon me?
I said a second ago is history. The minute I said what I just said, it was gone. It's history.
Exactly. Exactly. So intuition keeps you really clear about the present, and intuitive eating keeps you clear about your priorities and your values. And when you're clear about that, you have an extreme sense of confidence.
Let me give you a prime example of being mindful. Are you sitting near a desk?
Yes, I am.
Touch the desk.
I'm actually standing.
Okay, you're standing near a desk. Touch the desk.
Okay.
The desk just came into existence. Before you touched it, it wasn't even there. And that's being mindful. Most of us don't put it.
You mean the fact that I could see it wasn't real?
No, it wasn't even part of your existence. The desk didn't matter. And until you put your mind on it, the desk appeared and became real.
I hear you. That's true. But at the same time, like one of the intuitive tools, which I call intuitive self-defense for eating, is foresight. And foresight's like, you know, how you look both ways before you cross the street?
Yeah.
That's sure. Foresight. That's checking out the effect of what you're about to do before you do it so you don't get hit by a car.
Absolutely true. That's learned also. You know, it's like a
absolutely.
Kid.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all learned, and to not recognize our intuition is learned. Because children, like, what do you notice about little children? They ask a zillion questions, right?
Yes.
You know why they ask so many questions? Because the truth matters, and they're intuitive, and they're tuned in, and their curiosity is high because life hasn't beaten them down.
All right, let's move it to another point. And the word is, and this is where I think the kids are having a major problem today. Whatever's gone on with political correctness and the rest of it, we're going through life now without consequence. And if they don't think that there's consequence for their actions, there is no way that they're going to be able to intuitively, systematically, critically do any thinking to say, okay, if I eat this, what will happen to me? If I do, because they're being trained right now, and the word is trained, they're being socially engineered and trained in such a way that they can never lose. No matter what they do, it's okay. And if there is a problem, they've got somebody sitting there helping them and some kind of a counselor. So the key is that we have to realize, and one of the lessons I think has got to be learned is there's consequence for your action. You step out in the street without looking, you could get hit by a car.
And that's good intuition. And also, you know, what you're talking about is being self-reliant in our self-indulgent world, right?
Sure, yes.
And self-discipline is an important part of being intuitive. And even, you know, when you were talking about your friend who had the rubber band on her belly, you know, she also has to learn self-discipline because I talk about being an intuitive hedonist. An intuitive hedonist is a person who really drinks in the pleasures of life and is aware also that satisfaction is not found in excess. And in terms of our kids, I think there's a lot of signs everywhere that you have to be responsible for your actions. You just look at the BP disaster of last year, and you look at the horrible tsunami and earthquakes in Japan, and the action was what? That, you know, nuclear power was stored in a way that wasn't safe, and the consequences are real.
Tell youngsters not to get pregnant. I mean, I think that's really where you're dealing with the kids. Today, it's to call consequence, and I'm going to use the R word. I don't want to knock you down with this word, but responsibility. I know it's a tough word to handle at one time.
Well, I think, you know, I think my experience with kids is that when they take responsibility for themselves, they feel good about themselves. And I think kids getting pregnant are a symptom of deep problems in our society, and I don't think that they're happy about it at all. Do you?
I don't think it has to do with happy. I think it has to do with the ability to look at the consequence of what could happen when there's too much freedom in a particular way. Giving an 11-year-old kid a condom is not teaching them responsibility.
Well, it's not. Not only is it not teaching him responsibility, it's not teaching him self-respect.
Sure. No. By the way, and we're in agreement with this. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. So basically, what I would do is teach high school students the 10 intuitive tools, because my experience with people who I work with, because I coach people in intuitive eating, is that the tools are help them make decisions in all areas of their lives. Because when a girl gets pregnant and she's only a high school student or worse, a junior high school student, she doesn't realize that she had a choice. She doesn't realize that she could have taken control of her life.
Sure.
She doesn't understand anything about tenacity, which is a commitment to yourself.
No,
and
absolutely.
She certainly hasn't respected
that's
with
the key.
Dignity.
It's the not knowing the options and the choices that are there and the consequences of your actions. And I really believe that what you're saying, and I think it's powerful, because what you're saying is, just be mindful of what you're doing. And the biggest problems that they have today, they're not mindful. They're thinking 10 minutes ahead, 25 minutes behind, two days ahead.
Right, but that's because we have to give them the tools. And our society, our educational system is out of sync with the 21st century. If you look at it, our educational system and our penal systems are both ancient.
Yeah.
Everything else has changed, but we've got to overhaul those two. And in fact, it's very ironic, is in our educational system, we have to get back to teaching intrinsic values, which is what you and I are talking about, that make us human, that give us joy, and that are the whole reason for being alive, and stop teaching things that are basically transient and about material wealth.
Sure. And also, the other thing to add to that is that there are winners and there are losers. But if you've lost, it only means your lesson is to do more so you can be a winner. But if they don't allow people to do that, the kids to do that, where everybody's a winner, no matter what you do, you're getting a ribbon or a badge for something, it doesn't work, because it takes away from that intuitiveness.
Well,
you don't have
to. Right. There's no dignity in that, is there?
Nothing.
And you know what? And so you strip a child of self-respect, which is horrible.
Oh, and, I agree.
So what do you think we should do? What do you think is the way to help these kids help themselves?
Teach them what responsibility is. Teach them that there's consequence for their actions. And teach them that if they're not mindful, if they're not paying attention to what's going on, that they're going to be in trouble. And it's not necessarily trouble that they understand that they'll get into. It is trouble that's going to happen because they don't understand that there are not choices. They don't understand that there are opportunities there for them that they don't see because they're too wrapped up in themselves.
Well, I agree with you, but I feel that the way to do it is to approach it from a positive place, not a negative place.
Well, I think that's positive, because if you teach a person that there are options, there are choices they can have, and if you lay those out on the table, it eliminates them from having the problems that they have.
I agree. If you teach them that they have options, that's right. And you know, the most basic teaching, like the Ten Commandments, makes it clear what's right and what's wrong.
Sure.
And the golden rule is, if, you know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, is a really, really amazingly powerful rule.
Oh, yeah.
But the most important thing is, if these kids are really true to themselves, they will not do things that are self-destructive.
But they have Okay. All right, now here's where the key is. It's all a learning process. Life is a learning process. They have to learn that. And if there's no one there to teach them that, then they go out and get in trouble.
Right. So now we're talking about the family unit.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. No question. Right. And that's where it starts.
Right. And also, we're also talking we're also talking, when we're talking about that, we cannot ignore television. And we cannot ignore media, which teaches instant gratification, which is the opposite of what's real.
True.
And I believe in our society that really it's the responsibility of mass media, which is all powerful, to teach responsibility in a humble and real way, and not to lie constantly. I mean, if you sit around a table and you talk to kids about television commercials and you know and what they saw and what they think is real, especially the younger kids, they know what's real and what's not. But as we get older and we get stressed and indoctrinated,
I would have to at that point we'd have to separate on our road here, because those kids don't know what's real. The only thing they know what's real is what they've been told is real. They haven't been able to go out in the street, fall down, get back up, and find out for themselves what reality is.
Well, I didn't mean that kind of stuff. I'm just talking about, like, advertisements.
Oh, yeah. Now, by the way, the advertisements are, there's one purpose and one purpose only for an advertisement: make money. And they're going to say what they're going to say and do what they're going to do to get people to make that buying decision. And they're going to frame it every way they want to do. And when we have a world where our politicians do not tell us the truth because they want their own agendas, then we know we've got to have some change, and we do have to get mindful.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, no, I got
totally
it loud and clear,
agree.
And that's realistically what we have to look at. And I think going, and what you're talking about, because what you were saying tonight goes back tens of thousands of years, if not more than that. It's called get back to basics.
Right. Recognize everyday miracles and don't take things for granted, and enjoy your life because you're alive. Appreciate who you are and what you have.
Yeah,
and
no,
people
by the
don't
way,
take time
absolutely
to do that.
For that. I go to bed at night and I say, thank you. And I get up in the morning and I feel the same way. If I go to the store and I see someone older than I am, and that's hard to find anymore, but older than I am.
Well, you know, when I went to school, when I was growing up, originally we used to say Psalms and the Lord's Prayer every day before we said the pledge.
Sure.
And I thought that was so great. And, you know, we've lost that. And that's not really about any kind of religion as much as about really being appreciative of beauty and nature and the blessing of being alive.
Sure.
And I think that is one of the reasons why kids are getting pregnant. Is because they don't have that grounding of what's real.
Yeah, no question about it. We're starting to run out of time. Jane, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. I think the best one right now would be to go to Into Eating, intueating.com, all one word.
And we can buy the book there?
No, you can buy Fine Tuning there, my book about intuition. The Into Eating book is coming out in May. But you can reach me if you have any questions about eating or intuition.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure, Michael. Anytime, really. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, we'd love to have you back.
Thank
you.
Good night.
Heard us long as we're singing our song.
some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing now. Long as we're singing.
Hey, thank you for listening. And if you're listening on the web, tell your local radio stations about the show. That's the way we grow, and that's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.